CJAM 99.1 FM programming is hosted almost exclusively by community volunteers. The views and opinions expressed on the following program are that of the host and their guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of CJAM FM. For more information and resources, visit our website at cjam.ca.
Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. This first interview, folks, is a post-dated one, so some of the events referred to may already have happened. In this segment of our show, Trevor Gordon, Canadian Epilepsy Alliance, telling us a little bit about a petition following the Marcus Charles incident. So, recently the Epilepsy Alliance started a petition in regards to the Marcus Charles incident. Can you tell me a little bit about what happened and why the petition has needed to gain momentum?
So, this gentleman, Marcus Charles, who I would recommend your listeners Googling his name, to read the multiple stories that have been done, and there's a video that I'll warn your audience is quite upsetting to see. But this gentleman, basically, as he was finishing his shift at his job, experienced a seizure. 911 was called, and basically the police were called, and he was tased while having a seizure. So basically, that's obviously not the way to treat somebody when you're having a seizure. And the police treated him, basically tased him while he was having a seizure. There's plenty of articles about this, there's video about this, but this is not right, and this is why we created that petition.
So kind of speaks to a lot of the groups out there that have concerns about the impact of tasers in general. A lot of groups have argued they can do some long-term damage. When you're dealing with someone with epilepsy, one would think there'd be an even greater risk in so much as, you wouldn't be able to tell if it was an epileptic seizure or the result of the shock, I would imagine.
There's devices called, like, a VNS device, which is embedded in a person's body around the heart area, and just to think that if someone had a VNS device embedded in them, you know, and then they were tased, that could kill the person. You know what I mean? Like, I just want to be clear that I'm speaking on behalf of the Canadian Epilepsy Alliance. The Canadian Epilepsy Alliance does not condone any type of physical restraint when dealing with a seizure.
So, what were the circumstances that led the police to want to tase him in the first place? They suspect him of something?
So to be careful on what I say in this interview, Canadian Epilepsy Alliance is really only going based on articles that we've read about the situation. We weren't there, ultimately, but from the media reports and the witnesses, he was having a seizure, and the police were trying to restrain him. And they used type of force in the sense of being tased, control that. But again, I just want to be very quite careful with that. We weren't there. We're going by the media reports as well as the witnesses that were there. And the one thing I want to add too is that he has been charged for assault as well. In in addition to him being hazed, he was charged. Multiple charges, and he has a court date in the new year.
So, why did this become a concern for the Alliance? I mean, what was the initial reaction when the Alliance got word that someone with epilepsy had this risk created for them?
I think all of our first reactions was just sad and just and scared for this individual and just upset that this happened. This hasn't just happened in Hamilton. I mean, it's happened in multiple places across Canada, you know. So it's not an isolated incident. The reason why even we created a course for training was because an off-duty police officer in Ottawa had a seizure, and those who responded hazed him because they didn't recognize that he was having a seizure. In this case, the officer was newly diagnosed. This resulted in developing the program from an officer's point of view, so police across the country could be educated about epilepsy. But again, this has happened multiple times over the years. There have been cases where persons with epilepsy being hazed across the country. We've had issues in Halifax, Ottawa, obviously here in Ontario, out west. It's the whole reason we're encouraging police officers to take this training.
So what would be the ideal outcome of the training? Would you like the police to know most of all?
I think it's hard because it's like, the one thing I want to also be careful about, and I know all of us at Canadian Epilepsy Alliance we're not trying to disregard how hard it is to be a police officer and the great work that police officers do. We're just focusing on this situation that you should not hate someone having epilepsy or having a seizure. So just to simply even look at first aid training with respect to having a seizure, like you don't restrain someone. So I don't know how to say this. Ultimately, it's just to have a little bit of common sense to like give someone a little bit of loving care to, you know, give them their room and not to have them get injured. You know, push things out of the way so that they don't injure themselves if they happen to be, you know, kicking their leg. Don't hold them down while they're having this seizure. To understand that, you know, most seizures will only last a couple minutes. It will hopefully settle down. If it lasts a little bit longer than 5 minutes, obviously that's where you call 911 and you have, you know, the paramedics support that. But ultimately, holding someone down while they're having a seizure isn't going to, you know, react well. You know, and I mean, me myself, I've dealt with many of our clients having seizures, and sometimes in helping them not hurt themselves, I've been kicked here and there in helping someone. But I don't take it personal, and I don't, you know, hurt them. I don't react to them. I don't like try to, you know, do something in sort of retaliation, you know. So the hope is that this police course that they already have in their portal becomes a mandatory course. So that's why I know I might be repeating myself during this segment, but this is a police course that is already in their portal. Is that the issue is that it's not mandatory, and that's what the petition is hoping to do, is create more awareness of this course and to basically make this course mandatory.
So if you could send any message to the public and those in power about why it is that this should be mandatory, and why it is that there should be greater first aid and response training given, what would you say?
I apologize, you cut out on that last question.
If you could send any message to the public and our leaders as to why this should be mandatory and the benefits therein, what would you say? So if you could send any message about the need for this course to be mandatory and the benefits of it, what would you say?
I mean, 1 in 100 Canadians have epilepsy. This is not, this is not a small issue. You know, this affects almost 300,000 Canadians. And we need to create awareness, more awareness that not all disabilities are visible disabilities. And just because someone is shaking on the ground or being a little physical in a reaction, it's not something always intended, you know. And it's to have sometimes more awareness that the epilepsy could be someone having a seizure, and if someone's having a seizure, you know, learn the steps of how to deal with someone with a seizure so that it's done correctly. And if you happen to get kicked unintended, understand that it was unintentional, and the person isn't aware of what he or she is doing, and to show a little bit of loving care, for lack of better words. You know, it's not, but the bottom line is you shouldn't hate somebody when someone's having a seizure. The course is there, and that's the thing. It's not about a course not being available to them. The course is sitting in their portal, and it was designed partly from a police officer, you know, who has epilepsy. So we really want people to take that work.
So where can people go to find this petition, show their support?
They can go to our website, CanadianEpilepsyAlliance.org, CanadianEpilepsyAlliance.org. They'll see not only will they see the petition, they'll see the press release of what the Canadian Epilepsy Alliance is saying concerning this issue, and they'll also learn about the actual course itself.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Thank you for this, and thank you for always sharing these types of stories.
It's my pleasure. In this segment of our show, Patty Mayer will be telling us a little bit about Weaver syndrome. So, can you tell me a little bit about your experiences with Weaver syndrome?
Yes, it has to do with our son, who's 38 years old, Jeff. He was born in 1984, and he's almost 10 pounds when he was born. And so after going through Children's Hospital and seeing a geneticist, they labeled it as Weaver syndrome. And it has since been relabeled to Gibson-Cohen. We had gone through a geneticist study at the University of Vancouver in Canada, and they actually found a different mutation on a different gene that basically, you know, re-identified it as a Gibson-Cohen. It's an overgrowth syndrome, so it has to do with overgrowth. He was almost 10 pounds when he was born, and when he was 5 years old, he looked like he was 8, and when he was 8, he looked like he was 12, so always looked older and more capable than he actually was.
So can you tell me a little bit about some of the supports that you were able to find in order to be there for Jeff?
Fortunately, we're in the Bellevue, Washington area, and the supports were tremendous. After he was identified with the syndrome, they immediately connected us with it's called Kindering Center in Bellevue, and it's an early intervention program from 0 to 3. And they offered everything from PT, OT, speech. So he received the critical resources that he needed at the time. I mean, it was wonderful. It's still in the community and a great resource for parents. And then there's several out throughout the Seattle area also.
So in that sense, as he was growing up, looking older than he was, did that have any effect on his mental health or ability to interact?
Yes, he was very, because he knew he was challenged in his speaking. He was not comfortable speaking public or, you know, to even friends. He was very conscientious of not being able to articulate what he wanted to say, and extremely shy. So until it was probably maybe 10 years old where, you know, people within the family and friends could finally understand him, and he had a real hard time connecting the consonants and words, and was hard to understand. So until he could speak it, so others could understand him, he was pretty quiet. And now he's a chatterbox.
So in being connected with supports, I'd imagine that you were able to reach out to some other families affected by the syndrome.
Yes, so I started, in fact, another family, in fact, Weaver syndrome at the time, there's very few people that had been diagnosed with Leber syndrome. So a lady from Vancouver, Canada had reached out to me, and we started a support group for other families and became resources because there was hardly any information available at all for families with Leber syndrome. Dr. Weaver was actually lived in the Seattle area, and he was the one that I identified the syndrome at first. So there, we got requests from families all over the world for Leber syndrome, and finally put together a group of people that were willing to connect, and we could send them to medical resources. And one particular is in Johns Hopkins, a physician that was a student at the University of Washington through the genetics and became very knowledgeable about Leber syndrome. So I still, when I get requests from families, I will, you know, forward the information to her.
So in your time providing supports and your own journey, was there any success moment that stands out for you?
I mean, we relied so much on, I mean, talking about, you know, the supports, it's family, friends, and faith. So, you know, we had a really wonderful family support system. Grandparents that got him to his PT sessions. And I think, you know, the most memorable, well, many, but when he was able to speak, when he was, you know, you could understand him, that was a huge milestone because we weren't even sure that Jeff would even talk. So those moments, basically being able to participate in sports with the neighborhood, why there's so many, you know, I think about the milestones where he's come from and where he is now. And then right now, currently he works for a company that he's been with at 17 years, and they have been the most wonderful company to support Jeff and, you know, being valued at work. And I mean, Jeff can't wait to get up every morning to go to work because he loves the people he works with.
So if you could send any message to a parent or a family out there who might be wondering, what does this mean for my child? What would you say?
I think the biggest thing that we made sure that Jeff was a participant in the community, we wanted to make sure that, you know, he went to his neighborhood school. So when we were at the grocery store, when we were at the local businesses, that people recognized him. They knew who he was. And yeah, he was a part of the neighborhood. He was in scouts. We were in church. So, and then provided as many activities as far as sporting events, bicycle riding, snow skiing, trips, just exposing him to as much activities as possible. And then when he had, his brothers came along who are twins, they definitely motivated him to, you know, I want to do that too. So
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
So you're hanging with your inner circle. Maybe you're making cocktails. Maybe you're packing bowls. Even while we're distancing, it's important to remember, alcohol and cannabis each mess with your driving skills. Be cool. Make sure you and your friends get home safe. Take a cab if you need to. A few bucks could save a life. And we can do it again next weekend. A message from Arrive Alive, Drive Sober.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Patty Mayer told us a little bit about Weaver syndrome, and Trevor Gordon told us a little bit about an epilepsy petition. In this segment of our show, Kara Ayers will be telling us a little bit about her disabilities parenting research. So, you were featured prominently in a book about disability parenting experiences. Tell me a little bit about your story.
So my name is Kara. I have osteogenesis imperfecta, and what that basically is a bone condition that causes my bones to break easily. I was born with it. It's genetic. I use a wheelchair full time, and as does my husband. He also has osteogenesis imperfecta. So we actually knew each other just as acquaintances as kids, and then met again in our early 20s, dated many years, and then got married in 2009 and started our family shortly thereafter. So we have three kids now, ages 15. We adopted our 15-year-old son in 2014, but our first child was born in 2010, and she is 12 now, and then we have our youngest is 5.
So what are some of the concerns and barriers that were presented in the book concerning parents with disabilities being able to effectively raise kids?
Yeah, I mean, most of the barriers, as many parents emphasize in the book, are created by society, which I find both frustrating and hopeful, meaning that frustrating because, of course, they're so prominent in people's lives. The lack of understanding that we're families just like everyone else, and that even though we may do some things differently, that we love our children, that our children, are doing well, and when they're not, we're doing our best to help them get there. So a lot of the barriers that are discussed are things like lack of understanding, judgment, stigma about disability, lack of accessibility in our communities. You know, we, despite passing laws to make public spaces more accessible, we're still not there yet. And so a lot of the barriers are discussed that are kind of man-made, societally created. But why I do find that hopeful is that, you know, we can also turn those around and make a difference. So it's not like we are waiting some medical discovery or some, you know, huge invention that we haven't created it yet. Just as these were created by our society, we could decide that they were important enough to dismantle and to eliminate. So I think that gives me hope to work on these issues. So besides kind of living this life as a parent with a disability, I also am a researcher that studies the experience of families who are led by parents with disabilities. And I try to apply what I learn in terms of, you know, what policies do we need to better support these families, and what changes do we need to make to truly have a more just society for everybody.
So do you think that children growing up with parents with disabilities are more likely to have a greater understanding of what a disability really is rather than myths or stereotypes portrayed by society? Do you think that experience is advantageous in a way?
I do. And some of my recent work has tried to understand that even deeper. So I think, you know, beyond disability, so my kids definitely have an understanding of our disability, and then they've connected to other folks with disabilities. And so they've learned about, you know, I'm thinking of a few family friends that some have amputations. And so, you know, they've learned the difference between, they know that their dad and I, were both born with our disabilities. Some people acquire their disabilities, whether it be through an accident or through an illness. You know, they know that some people's disabilities get worse over time and they lose functioning, whereas other people stay about the same. And so beyond, you know, knowing all about, well, not all about, but a lot about disability specifically, I've also seen them have a greater understanding of broader things like adapting to challenge, being resilient in that when you get knocked down, you get up, and how that can be hard, but how important it is. So yeah, some of my recent work, I've wanted to understand more what are the unique strengths within these families. So we spend a lot of time kind of defending ourselves because there's this question of like, can you even do this as well as non-disabled parent? But what if we looked at it differently and asked, you know, why are we comparing ourselves to non-disabled parents? What unique strengths do we have as disabled parents? And also not comparing our kids to kids of non-disabled parents, but what kinds of strengths emerge from our children raised by disabled parents?
So one of the things that led me to wanting to talk to you about this was the fact that some people had actually had child protective services called based on little more than the presumption that someone with a disability wouldn't be a fit parent. You find that these myths can be challenged, that comes from a lack of understanding. I mean, anybody can acquire a disability at any time. So love your thoughts on this.
Yeah, I think that is a terrifying reality faced by many parents with disabilities, in that many of us have heard many stories of parents literally doing nothing and having their children removed on the basis of suspicion or hypothetical concerns, things like, you know, a deaf mother having her baby removed because the nurse wondered, well, how would she hear the baby cry? And not being aware that there are readily available devices out there that alert deaf parents, not only actually that their baby's crying, but some of these devices even decipher what kind of cry it might be. Is it more likely to be a hunger cry, a pain cry? You know, something that, do we even know that in the early days of parenting our newborns as hearing parents? You know, I mean, I know it took me a while as a new mom to figure out that there were different kinds of cries. So the nurse simply not being aware that there are ways to adapt as a deaf parent led that nurse to trigger the Child Protective Services investigation. And then frustratingly, instead of Child Protective Services saying, you know, we won't respond to a hypothetical complaint, this family has not abused or neglected this child, instead of that happening, you know, CPS also follows and says, oh, you know, we should investigate this family, and in the meantime, we'll remove the baby. And that's, you know, a wrong that you can't make right. I mean, you can't give families back time with a child. If the child is older, you can't, you know, address the trauma and the fear of that for them. I mean, I still think about it with my own family in terms of when I hear, you know, maybe my youngest come home and say that someone at school asked a lot of questions about our family. I can't help but wonder, you know, was it genuine curiosity? Was it a teacher trying to support my daughter, which of course I want? Or was it somebody that has doubts about our family and they're trying to gather information to perhaps, you know, report our family? So it creeps in. It's a legitimate fear that, you know, unfortunately is a reality for many parents with disabilities.
So what message would you send to society about why it is that this should be taken on the basis of the person, not the presumption?
Yeah, I think we could all benefit from some help understanding the policies that we have in place in hopes to protect our children, our society's children, from abuse and neglect. So we should understand that parents with disabilities are, you know, under the same expectation to not abuse or neglect their child. So of course, if a parent with a disability also was abusive or also was actively neglecting their child, not providing, you know, the basics that a child needs, love, you know, and all the other things that a child needs, right? For various reasons, parents may not be able to provide that. Of course, that parent needs support, needs intervention from the system, because that child should be protected. But we need to understand that that is vastly different from us guessing that a parent, because of their disability, is going to abuse and neglect, without having any understanding that people with disabilities, whether they're parents or not, adapt in so many ways, and they adapt every day to their surroundings. And we don't necessarily see that as a stranger, you know, or as a outside person, whether it be a nurse or a teacher or a neighbor. And so recognizing that, just like I don't know what my neighbors do behind their closed doors, you know, they don't know the different ways that I've adapted my home to make sure that I can, you know, cook safely without my five-year-old, now she's older, but, you know, without, like, there's lots of little things I've done around my home to make sure that I keep my child safe, just like any other parent. And it may look a little different because I'm about the same size as my young child, so I can't do it the more basic or the more common way, which is just put everything up high. So I think that's the main myth we need to break, is that just because somebody's not doing something the way you did doesn't mean it doesn't work, doesn't mean that we don't all have the same goal, that we want to take care of our kids. And I think it's important to know, to put people's mind at ease, that if abuse or neglect is happening, of course, I am not suggesting that disabled parents, you know, are not responsible for keeping their kids safe. They are. But what I'm concerned about is these, you know, allegations that are completely baseless and are just based on a lack of understanding and ignorance about disability.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. My friends, this petition is a much-needed reminder that in disability life, we must never settle for what is simply good enough. We must always be looking for ways to support the disability community, to create opportunities to help such people reach their best, which is the right of everyone, no matter who they are, where they come from, what their abilities are. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.